Okay, so we've spent the last few weeks discussing simulations, and specifically the last lecture was addressed drawing meaningful conclusions from observations of the output of our simulation models. Okay, and again we noted that the outputs were a single instance of a stochastic process, and observing that instant by itself was not necessarily that useful, but rather we needed to take multiple samples. Okay, and then we looked at what conclusions we could draw about the multiple samples, and we said that we could estimate system parameters by taking sample averages over the parameter calculated for each individual run. Okay, and in this fashion we could look at, we could come up with estimates for mean, variance, percentile, and interval probability. Okay, and one thing I should say here is that this was for systems in steady state, so we assumed that these values were fixed. The sample average gave us an estimate of our system parameter, and then we could use the idea of a confidence interval to in some way quantify how good an estimate our sample average was. Okay, and so we noted that it relied on the values we calculated being independent and identically distributed, which was the case for our mean, but we saw later was not the case for our variance. Okay. And assuming IID, then our sample average eventually had, if you took enough sample points, had a normal distribution, and you use this normal distribution to construct the confidence interval. Okay, and that just gave you paired a probability and at this interval and said that with that probability, your system parameter was in the interval around your sampled, estimated parameter. And so that was, again, the core idea. Then we just looked at other permutations. Students T could be used if we did not have enough values to achieve our normal distribution. And we saw that the confidence intervals that you got through the use of students T were in general wider than those if you had your normal distribution. And then we said a few words about how to gather our estimates of the system parameter. And so sort of the most conceptually straightforward, it would be the replication method, which just says that, you know, however many samples you wish to take, make that many runs. We also noted that you could arrive at the same results using a batch means, which means chunking a single run up into multiple pieces, but each piece then would have to be significantly large that you were minimizing the correlation from one estimate to the next. Okay, and so again, that should be sort of all you need to know to certainly do the first assignment. Now we're going to move on to the idea of analysis, queuing analysis. Through a few examples what exactly we can represent with queues and what sort of mathematical theory can we bring to bear on queues. Throughout the discussion of simulation, we did look at a queue and think about how we could simulate our queue. Now we're going to come up with mathematical representations and see what results we can achieve mathematically. In general, you have to make more simplifying assumptions than you would representing things via simulation, and we'll see what those assumptions are as we go along. So, we have some feel for the types of systems that we're looking at through, again, our basic review and our examples that we've used in the simulation discussion. So, we're looking at either elements within a network or potentially the network itself. And so we would have nodes and routers, or again, connections of those entities. We know that these are very complex systems, and there is unpredictability in them. So we have we cannot say for certain how the data is going to arrive, or possibly how much data is going to arrive. The service of the data depends on the characteristics and the resources available, so again, that's unpredictable. And potentially we have loss, so errors in the system, which adds more layers of unpredictability. We have seen that that had impact on the quality of service. So just the construction of the network leads to delay, variability in the delay, and loss. Okay, and we saw that the different types of data sort of responded to those quality of service measures or quantities in different ways. So data in general, we saw, had to be correct, so loss was a problem. And could be anything from small to large, and your classic data did not arrive in any sort of predictable pattern. Voice and video were more predictable in terms of arrival rates, and hence, as we play them out over the network, are more sensitive to delay and jitter. Our classic voice encoding is a constant bit rate of 64 kilobits per second. Can tolerate some errors. Video, again, would, without encoding, would be of fixed rate, of much higher rates. And again, you can probably interpolate between samples to eliminate problems, so it is tolerant of errors. Coded voice and video would have smaller bit rates than their original representations, but possibly in order to decode, you're going to need to have many fewer errors. Also, the encoding process in general leads to a variable bit rate. So all of these things are indicating that there's a lot of unpredictability in our network. And so, you know, we have individual users sending in, you know, whatever data their application requires, and then we have a number of users, and an unpredictable number of users. Okay, so one of the key tools that we use to analyze these systems is queuing. And what a queue is just that. It's a line, it's jobs, customers, what have you, waiting for service. Typically, we make some assumptions, so we assume that the customers that are require or jobs requiring service are identical in their properties, and that we have some server which serves these customers or jobs. The unpredictability, of course, comes from the behavior of the customers and the characteristics of the jobs that they present. Okay, and so this leads to unpredictability in arrivals to the system and unpredictability in the time of service within the system. Okay, so if we knew everything in advance, then we could provision the system and the work to match exactly, but we, in general, we don't know this. Okay. We could potentially sort of through observations determine what the peak demand of the for the system was, but allocating for peak demand would require sort of a lot of resources, potentially more resources than we wish to commit, particularly if the peak demand is significantly greater than, for instance, the average demand. Okay, so we have this case where we can't sort of optimize the number of resources that we allocate. So we, in general, need to allocate more than is required, for instance, for an average, but however many resources we allocate, in the case of if the system is genuinely random, then there will always be times that we do not have enough resources to serve the current demand. Okay. Typically, within our data networks, what we've seen is that in that case, jobs are stored for processing when the resources become available. Okay. Now, the underlying theory, our queuing theory, is going to apply no matter what our customer or service regime is, as long as we can describe it in a probabilistic manner. Okay, so there's lots of examples of queues. Every day, you know, we queue for buses. We can see some examples here. So we have sort of transport, and our customers then become whatever vehicles, airplanes, ships, or trucks. The servers then are sort of access to whatever resources they need to move. So the airplanes need runways, ships, dock, and trucks. Again, they need they need service, so they need to be loaded. Okay. And airplanes would sort of wait in stacks. Ships and trucks similarly wait, and we then have time for them to be loaded. Customers, again, wait. Shoppers at the grocery store wait in checkout lines. Banks wait for tellers, again, in lines. Public services, again, have waiting. We have firemen, and if we have fires, we have firemen, and hopefully not too much waiting going on. Doctors have patients, which, again, the patients wait in the waiting room. People wait for houses on lists. More interesting for us, again, are sort of electronic networking. And we can think of this as being either telephone or data networks. And so telephone calls have switches and links, and actually, typically we assume that they don't sort of queue in the classical sense, in that once you exceed the capacity of the network, there's no more customers. The customers do not wait. But what we'll see is that there is actually the capacity within the system can be thought of as a place for holding customers. In our data networks, then we have nodes and transmission lines, and so messages are buffered at the nodes until the transmission lines are available. Okay. So, there's a number of components to these queues that are important. Usually we think we have a population of customers, and we have to then describe in what way they're arriving in the system. So we have to have some sort of arrival process to describe how customers arrive in the system. What they're waiting for then is servers. Okay, and there's some description of how long it will take once they're assigned a server, how long will it take for them to be served, so to be processed by their server. Okay, and so this leads to having a number of places in the system, and those places are comprised of the servers plus the queue. Okay. Plus, the people waiting. So, the number of people in the systems is you have people waiting and people being served. Okay. And then we need some rule, and if we assume that these people, again, line up, we need some rule that says how they will be assigned servers. And that's called the service discipline. Okay. So, these are the important components that we need to describe our queue and the things that we're going to see are important about the queue is we're going to ask questions about time, so how long are people waiting, and about the queue size, how many people are waiting in the system. Okay, and as I said, the queue size is the number of people waiting for a server plus the number of people being served. Okay, so it's the total number of people in the system. Okay. So, again, we think of, the jobs or people arriving. There's some buffer. We say they arrive at a rate lambda, and if they arrive to a busy system, then they queue up in buffers and eventually are assigned servers, and we have M servers. Again, we assume that the servers all act in the same fashion, and there is a service rate mu. Okay. So, if from between one job and the next, we have what's called an inter-arrival time, tau. And so we see tau here. We have an arrival and then another arrival. And then in terms of time, the arrival will wait for some period of time, and the time it spends in the system will be divided between waiting time, which is the time between the arrival and the start of the job, and the service time, which is the time between the beginning and end of the job. The total time that the job spends in the system we refer to as the response time. And so that's the sum of the waiting time and the service time. Okay, so that's from the customer perspective, that's what's going on. And customers are mainly concerned with how long is it taking them to get their service. From the system point of view, the question that we can ask is, well, how many jobs are there in the system? And again, the number of jobs in the system breaks down to the number of jobs waiting for service and the number of jobs in service. Okay. So, all of these quantities, so our time quantities and our numbers in queue, these are all random variables, so all of these are unpredictable in nature. Obviously, that's with the exception of our rates, which define the randomness for our arrival and service. Queues all the these components for the queue are denoted using what's called Kendall notation. And so Kendall notation just allows us to describe these six components. So the first component A is the inter-arrival time distribution. The second component S is the service time distribution. Third component M is the number of servers. Fourth is the queue size, so that's the size of the system overall. So that's servers plus waiting space. K is the population size. In general, we're not going to worry about that, but it's possible you only have a finite number of customers. In general, we're going to assume that we have an infinite number of customers. And finally, SD is a service discipline. So how are we assigning customers to our servers? And so, again, the most likely is first come, first served. We can have last come, first served. We can have priority, queuing, etc. Okay. And so again, in terms of arrival and service discipline, M refers to the exponential distribution, inter-arrival times. E is error-long, H is hyper-exponential, D is deterministic, G is general. And as we move through the lecture, we're generally going to assume that our arrivals, at least, are exponential, and we'll see that it's a lot easier to deal with the queues and derive results for the queues if both arrival and service time are assumed to be exponential. Okay, so for our purposes, we're trying to see how queues relate to data networks. And so, I think we're comfortable with the idea that the data flow through the network is stochastic in nature. And so at any point in the network, the time of arrival of the basic data units is a random variable. Okay. And so if you think about, a node or a packet traversing multiple hops through the network, each time it arrives at a node, then due to statistical multiplexing, it will, if the node is busy and can't transmit it out on a link, it will wait and it will be stored in a buffer. The time to process a message over a channel is typically dependent on the size of the message. And so this means that since the size of the message is sort of outside of our control, by and large, this means that the processing time for the message is also random. Now it's important that our system be stable, and what that means is essentially that just that we cannot have a case where the number of jobs waiting for service is growing to infinity over time. And basically what we're going to need is that the rate of arrival is less than the rate of departure. Okay, so we can think of sort of our network as just something, you know, users are sending messages into, and eventually these messages are departing. And again, that could be the network, you know, sort of a network as a whole, or it could be a single node within a network. We're going to assume that no messages are created or destroyed within the network. Okay, since obviously that would sort of complicate the picture. So that means that messages can either go in and exit the network, or go in and be stored in the network. And so we assume that when a message receives service, then it exits. Okay. So, it's sort of as we would intuitively think, if the input rate across the boundary exceeds the output rate, then the number of messages that's stored within the network has to be increasing. If we look at any given time and the output rate is exceeding the input rate, then that's okay. That just means that the number of jobs stored decreases to zero, and at this point, the output rate no longer exceeds the input rate. So the output rate will become zero as well. Okay. So what this means is that there is a distinction between output rate and service rate, in that service rate is just saying, if you have a job, this is how fast you can process it. Output rate is just saying that it's just an observation of what's actually coming out of the network, which, as we see, is dependent on what has gone into the network. Okay. So the condition of stability for our system, is that the arrival rate is less than the service rate. Okay, that means that you can service jobs faster than they arrive. And that's on average, those are rates, so on average. Okay. If a system is stable, then it will achieve steady state. And in steady state, the input rate has to equal the output rate. Also, the second condition, the second characteristic of steady state is that the average number, when we're in steady state, the average number of jobs in the system converges. So we have a steady estimate. We can get a steady estimate for that number of jobs. Okay, and so that's essentially the same as what we were talking about for our simulation results as well. Okay, so steady state is going to be, or stable system, we are going to assume that our systems are stable, so our queues are stable, so we're always going to require that our output rate, our service rate, is greater than our input rate. And then, again, we're going to ask about sort of system parameters when we are in steady state. And again, typically what we'll be concerned with is, for customers, what's their average waiting time? For the system itself, what's the average number of jobs in the system? Potentially, we might also ask, can we assign a distribution to the number of jobs within the system. So can we discover a probability of there being one job, two jobs, three jobs, etc. Okay. And we'll see that answering these questions is, or the ease with which we can answer these questions is, again, going to be dependent on our arrival discipline, our inter-arrival discipline, and our service discipline. Okay. Now, we're going to look again at what sort of questions we can answer, making sort of various constraints on these disciplines. The first result that we look at is what's called Little's Law, and Little's Law is interesting in that it actually doesn't matter what your distribution, your arrival and service distributions are. No matter what these distributions, Little's Law relates the arrival rate, the average waiting time, and the average queue length for stable queues. Okay. So, we'll state Little's Law, we'll look at some examples, and then we'll look at a proof of Little's Law. Okay. So, again, we assume that we aren't losing jobs. So what goes in eventually comes out. And so we have Form 1 of Little's Law. The mean number of jobs in the system is the arrival rate times the mean response time. We can also look at the jobs sort of being buffered as opposed to receiving service, and again the mean number of jobs waiting is the arrival rate times the mean waiting time then. Okay. We can use Little's Law in the case where jobs are lost, but to do this we have to define what's called an effective arrival rate. So instead of the actual arrival rate, we look at the arrival rate of the jobs that actually get into the system. If the job does not get into the system, it doesn't factor into that arrival rate. And that should make sense. Obviously, we're dealing with sort of the behavior of the system, so if it doesn't even get into the system, it shouldn't factor into that calculation. Okay, so we'll start with an example. We have customers arriving at a fast food restaurant at a rate of 5 per minute, and they wait an average of 5 minutes to receive their order. They eat in the restaurant with a probability of 1/2 and take their food away with a probability of 1/2. Eating in the restaurant takes an average of 20 minutes. And so the question is, what is the average number of customers in the restaurant? Okay. So we can approach this sort of either by looking at the restaurant as a whole or by examining various components of the restaurant, so the queue for food and then the seating, the restaurant seating, we can look at as sort of separate factors. And what we'll see is that we actually arrive, whether we break the problem up into components or look at the system as a whole, then we will arrive at the same results. Okay. So first we'll look at the system as a whole. And so we say little law says n equals lambda t. We know what lambda is. It's 5 customers per minute. Now, what's the average waiting time for that customer? Well, half of the customers are going to spend 5 minutes. And then half of the customers are going to spend 5 plus 20 minutes. Okay. And so what that'll give is everybody's spending 5 minutes, and then half of them are spending an additional 20. So on average, their customers spend an additional 10 or 15 minutes total. So the number of customers in the restaurant by Little's law is then 5 times 15, or 75 customers. We can then look at the components of the system separately. And so we have a queue, or sorry, a line with people waiting for access to food, and then the seating area, so people using the seating area. And what we see is that, the customers enter the line at a rate of 5 customers per minute. And now they take an average of 5 minutes to receive their order. So you can think the number of people in line waiting for their food is 25. I should say the number of people waiting for the food is 25. Now, half the people waiting for their food will then enter and will then look for a seat and sit down. And so that means that they're arriving to eat in at a rate of 2.5 customers per minute. And the time spent eating in is 20 minutes. So that means that, in general, we have 50 customers eating in. The total number of customers in the system then is going to be n line plus n eat in, or again 75. Okay. So it's worth having a look at sort of how this works and how we can and it's fairly straightforward to prove. So we can look at what's happening in the system as a function of time, sort of as time goes on, what's happening in the system. And we let alpha of t be the number of jobs entering into the system, and so that's going to keep increasing. Delta of t is the number of jobs exiting the system. And again, that's increasing. And obviously, at any point in time t, then n of t, the number of jobs in the system, is the number that have arrived minus the number that have been served. Okay. And then we will define gamma of t being the total time that all jobs have spent in the system up to time t. Okay. So now we're going to look at, again, if we fix some time t, what's happening up till that point, and then we're going to try and push out that point farther and farther to see, is there globally in the system what's happening. So we're going to define NT to be the average number of jobs in the system, again, up that average up to point T, and we're going to say that it's equal to gamma T over T, okay, where gamma T, again, was the total time that the jobs are spent in the system. Okay, and it makes some intuitive sense, but it's not completely obvious. So we'll return to that figure later. T of T is the average time spent in the system by a single job. And so that's, again, that's the total amount of time divided by the number of jobs. And so we can derive our flow rates by averaging our system quantities over time. So our arrival rate is given by alpha t over t. And then if we, again, assume that nt is gamma t over t, then we can introduce alpha into the equation, top and bottom, and we then combine alpha t over t and gamma t over alpha. And we see that alpha t over t is lambda t, and gamma t over alpha t is t of t. Okay. Ah, darn it. Excuse me. So these quantities, that's just defined over a period from 0 to t. And what we'd like to do is let time go off to infinity then. If we do that, then lambda t becomes lambda. The limit of n of t becomes n, and the limit of t of t becomes t. And given that, we have our Little's law result that we have n equals lambda times t. Okay, so the average, and again, the average number of jobs stored in the system is equal to the product of the average arrival rates to the system and the average time the jobs spend in the system. So the only thing we have left to do then is to convince ourselves that n of t equals the average number of jobs in the system is gamma t over t. Okay. So to convince ourselves of that, we're going to, again, look at the number of jobs in the system at any fixed time. That's going to be n of t. And reason about gamma of t relative to n of t. Okay. So the total number of jobs stored in the system, again, is going to be the difference between our arrival process alpha of t and our departure process delta of t. Okay. The time a job spends in the system then is dependent on the time between arrival and departure, and for and just to give us some intuition, we're going to assume that our service discipline is first in, first out. So each arrival, the arrival is, or the arrivals, the departures occur in the same order as the arrivals. So that means that the time is, again, the time between an arrival and the next departure. Okay, so going back to this one where it's easier to see, we have our first arrival, and the time is the difference between that arrival and the departure, and the second arrival is the time, and the time spent is the time between that arrival and the next departure, the third and the third departure, the fourth and the fourth departure, etc. Okay. And so the N of T, our quantity that we're trying to reason about, is the time average of N of T now. So I get 1 over T, and that's given by 1 over T, integral from 0 to T, N of tau d tau. And again, this is going to be 1 over T times the area under the N of T curve. But gamma of T, which is comprised of our different waiting times, so the waiting time of each of these, what we see is that's also the area under this given curve. Okay. So we have that N of T is indeed 1 over T gamma sub T. Okay. We can look at, excuse me, the same thing now in terms of other service disciplines. So, for instance, if we have last in, first out, and so for last in, first out, we are going to have to pair up the arrivals and departures differently. So here, for last in, first out, well, the first arrival is the first to depart because it's the only one in the system. The second arrival is actually the last to depart. The third arrival is the third to depart, and the fourth arrival is actually the second to depart. Okay. But what we see again is that we cover the same area under the curve, and so we have the same result. Okay, so again, what's interesting about Little's Law, the main is, well, again, we can relate these quantities, and these are system averages, but they don't actually depend in any way on the anything more significant about the distributions. So we could have any distribution for the arrival times, any inter-arrival times, any distribution for the service times, and we'd still get the same results as long as the rates were the same. Okay, so again, to fix sort of an example in our mind, we can think of a buffer and channel model. And so if we have jobs arriving at a node, then they have, again, some rate of arrival. They are buffered if more jobs have arrived than have been serviced, then they're buffered. And the service time then is dependent on the message length and the rate at which the job at which the bits can be transmitted. Okay. So there is a minimum delay within the system of the time it takes the bits to be transmitted. So that's if you receive service immediately. If you have to wait, obviously you go up from that minimum delay. So our average transmission time is given by the average message length divided by the bit rate, and we'll say that's 1 over mu seconds, where mu is the average transmission rate in messages per second then. The difference between lambda and mu is going to be accounted for by the fact that the channel is not always busy. Okay, so lambda is less than mu. Okay, so again, that's the service rate can be greater than the arrival rate. That just means that at some point the servers will be idle. Okay. We say that we generally relate lambda and mu then and say lambda equals rho mu, where rho is the proportion of time the channel is busy. Okay, so that gives you the scaling. So some proportion of time the giant channel is idle, and essentially you can think of a service rate of zero if it's idle, and then at others it's busy. Okay. We cannot have a case where lambda is greater than mu, because if we did, then the buffer, the number of jobs needing to be stored would grow and grow and grow over time. And eventually, you know, as a practical issue, we do only have finite buffers, so we would exceed the buffer capacity. Yeah, excuse me. We can consider the separation of the buffer and the channel, and so now we have sort of total number of jobs in the system. It's governed by our arrival rate lambda, but consists of jobs waiting to be transmitted plus a job being transmitted. A job or possibly jobs if you have multiple lines going out. So N is the total, on average, the total number of jobs in the system. So that's in the buffer plus the channel. NQ is the number stored in the buffer alone. And Little's Law can apply again to the whole system or components of the system. So for the whole system, we have N equals lambda times T, the time the job spends in the system. And we can also have NQ is lambda times W, the time that we're in the buffer only. So the difference between T and W then is given by the time it takes to serve a job. And we can have, given that, we have T is W plus 1 over mu, where mu is the service rate. Plugging our value of T into Little's Law, then we have N is lambda W plus lambda over mu. Okay. And so again, lambda W is NQ, the number of average number of jobs being stored. And then lambda over mu is essentially the average number of jobs in service. And this is our quantity rho, and it's a number less, that has to be a number less than one. So the average is given, you either have a job in service or if we assume we have one server, then you have a job in service or nothing, or perhaps the system is empty. And the proportion of time for for each case is given by rho then. Okay, so Little's Law applies to any distribution. Most other results in queuing are dependent on having a Poisson arrival process. Okay. And so if you look at Little's Law, again, what we say is that if you know N or you know T, you can find the other. Well, what we haven't said is how we can calculate either N or T. And so if we have Poisson arrival processes, then we will be able to actually calculate values for N and T. Okay. We will need to know something about the service process as well. We will need not just the average, but we'll need the second moment. Okay, so the quantity related to the variance. Okay. And so we're going to look at the results for general distributions, deterministic distributions for the service discipline, and then Poisson distributions. Okay. So, generally, the next set of results we'll derive is for a general distribution. We can then mm-hmm. it's for a general distribution, but within that, of course, any sort of specified distribution also counts. Okay, so the first thing we're going to do, before we get in, dive into those results, we're going to have a deeper look at what we mean by Poisson arrivals. Okay. And so now we have our channel model, and we have our arrival rate lambda, but we're now going to assume that arrivals are distributed in this Poisson fashion. We're not going to make any big assumptions about the service discipline. We're just going to assume that we have some random message length, and that's, of course, what defines the processing time. Okay. We will assume that we have an average message processing time given by 1 over mu, which is, again, the length of the message divided by the bit rate at which it's being transmitted. We defined the Poisson process previously when we were talking about probabilities, and so it's a process for which the number of arrivals in any time interval is statistically independent from the number in any other non-overlapping interval. And we said that the probability of having k arrivals in t seconds was given by lambda t to the k, e to the minus lambda t over k factorial, where lambda is the average arrival rate of which gives us that in a one time unit, we'd have lambda arrivals. Okay, so we're going to have sort of a deeper look now at what this arrival process means. And so we'll see that it can be interpreted as having a lot of different inputs that all have a very small probability of occurring in any given interval. Okay. And so, in general, the Poisson arrival process is valid in the case that you have a lot of different users, okay? And there are a lot of different sources for your traffic. Okay. So, we're going to assume that the average number of calls, that we have an arrival rate, so the average number of calls in any period of time, t is lambda t. Okay. Now, we want to know what's the probability of having k arrivals in our time t, then, so we want to develop a distribution for this, and so we think about this by dividing our interval t into n pieces, and so the expected number of arrivals in any given piece, then, is given by lambda t over n. Okay. We're going to make an assumption that we can make n large enough that you can have at most one arrival in any interval. Then the probability of having an arrival is given by lambda t over n. And then the other possibility is that you, in this interval, you don't have an arrival, which is just 1 minus the probability that you have a single arrival. So that means that the way that in order to have k arrivals in this interval, then you, in k of the n, you must have had a single arrival in k of the n possible slots. Obviously, that can happen in any of n choose k ways, and the probability of having k arrivals exactly is lambda t over n to the k times 1 minus lambda t over n to the n minus k. And again, you have n choose way k's of having k slots occupied. We can then see, as n gets large, what happens to this. So as n gets large, n choose k becomes n to the k over k factorial. Pk, we just plug in that value for n choose k. And we can look at now the limit of what's happening as n gets large. So as n gets large, the limit of 1 minus lambda t over n to the minus k becomes 1. Oh, that makes sense, because n, as n gets large, you essentially have 1. And the limit of 1 minus lambda t over n to the minus n is e to the minus lambda t. Okay, so that's just a result that we'll just use. And plugging that all in, we get pk is n to the k over k factorial lambda t over n to the k e to the minus lambda t. Okay, and so that gives us our, that's our Poisson process. Okay, so we can see, I should probably should have put one more line in there. You can see that the n factors will cancel out, and you'll get lambda t to the k over k factorial e to the minus lambda t. I should probably put that explicitly in, but you can cancel out the n to the k's. Okay. So, again, this gives us this interpretation of having lots of lots of sources with a sort of a low probability of any given source, an aggregate arrival rate of lambda, which means obviously the rate for any single source is much lower. Okay, so what interesting properties does the Poisson arrival process have? Well, the first one is that in some ways it represents a maximum amount of randomness, a maximum amount of just uncertainty. And we can see that in the inter-arrival time associated with this process. Okay, and we said again before that if you had Poisson arrivals, so then they had the time between any two arrivals was distributed in an exponential fashion. Okay, so we're going to show that now. And so we want a distribution for the time separation between adjacent packets. Okay. So we start by looking at the event t greater than t, and note that this is equivalent to there being no arrivals occurring before time t, little t. And for our Poisson process, that's given by P0 is e to the minus lambda t. Our CDF then is looking for the probability, the reverse of the opposite event, that t is less than or equal to t. And so that's just 1 minus our P0, or 1 minus e to the minus lambda t. The PDF is then obtained by taking the derivative of our CDF, and that gives you lambda e to the minus lambda t. And that is our exponential distribution. Exponential distributions have what is called a memoryless property. And intuitively, what the memoryless property says is that it doesn't matter what's gone on before. You still have, moving into the future, the same likelihoods you would have had to begin with. And so the way we say that, sort of more mathematically, is that the probability that t is greater than t plus epsilon, given t is greater than t, is the probability of that t is greater than epsilon. So, again, if you have arrived at any point within your system, the only thing that is governing the probabilities moving forward is the amount of time from that point forward. So we can prove that. We can look at two events, t greater than t and t greater than t plus epsilon. We know what the probability for those is. We did that before. It's e to the minus lambda t, and e to the minus, it should be capital T there, and e to the minus lambda. This should be a small t. Okay, so I'll correct those notes before I post them, but this should be small t and this should be small t. Okay, so we can recall our definition of conditional probability. So it's the probability of the intersection of events over the probability of the conditional event. And so we get the probability of t greater than t plus epsilon given t greater than t is probability t greater than t plus epsilon intersect t greater than t over probability of I've lost it altogether. Okay. Probably t greater than t. Okay, so I will clean up the notation there before I post the notes. Now, what's the probability of t greater than t plus epsilon intersect t greater than t? Well, for t to be greater than t plus epsilon, it has to be greater than t. So it's just the probability of t greater than t plus epsilon. the probability, and then the probability of t greater than t. So we get e to the minus lambda t plus epsilon over e to the minus lambda t is e to the minus lambda epsilon. And that's the probability that t is greater than epsilon. Okay. So if you look at it at any point and try and define the distribution, it just matters how far you go from that point. And so again, that's intuitively the least you could possibly know about a system. Just no matter where you are, the same things are happening. Okay, so I'll clean up the notation there before posting the notes. The interpretation of a Poisson process. So in terms of arrivals, again, we get this maximal unpredictability. And we have some idea that if you have lots of sources sending at, rates that aren't blowing up, then you get something that looks Poisson. Now, in terms of departures, it's not clear that it makes quite as much sense. In terms of departures, we'd say that we have exponential service distribution times, but this is going to mean, in terms of any given job, that the probability of the job is independent of how long the job has been in service already. And sort of intuitively, again, that doesn't make quite as much sense, but we frequently will assume this sort of distribution just because it makes our mathematics a lot easier, and it has, we'll see that it has properties that are desirable. Okay, so the Poisson arrival process has this randomness. And this leads to what's called the pasta property of Poisson arrivals, which is, again, what is going to make our work a lot easier. And this the pasta property is Poisson arrivals C-time averages. And what that means is that the proportion of arrivals that occur when a queuing system is in some state K is equal to the proportion of time that system spends in state K, so again, the arrival is, the likelihood of arriving to any system state is related to the amount of time that the system spends in that state. So this property does not hold for all distributions. So an easy example is to look at a deterministic queue where it takes the service time is half the inter-arrival time. And what that means, obviously, is that, again, each customer that arrives is serviced before the arrival of the next customer. So the customer is always going to arrive to an empty system, even though the system is actually busy half the time. Okay. Now, if we assume our Poisson arrivals, then we can sort of make some definitions relating the busyness of the system to the arrivals and departures. Okay. And so what we're going to do is look at the time it takes, or look at the period of time it takes to serve a single message. Okay, so we have a processing time for a single message. So if we have message I departing, then the next one being processed. It starts at time ti and ends at time ti plus 1. At that point in time, there's a number of jobs in the system. And when the message departs, there's a number of jobs in the system, a different number, ni plus 1 jobs in the system. In between those two times, we have, in between the processing time, we have a number of arrivals. Okay. So we can define our the number of jobs in the system at these arrival and departure times. If ni was greater than 0, so if there's somebody waiting to get service, then the next number in queue is you need to subtract the number, the job that got serviced, and then add on however many jobs arrived. Otherwise, it's just the number of jobs that arrive. Okay, so we can pull that into a single equation by defining a unity function, u and I, which is 1 if ni is greater than 0, or 0 if ni is 0. And so we can combine our two equations. We get ni plus 1 is ni minus u and I plus ai plus 1. We can then try to average both sides. So we average ni plus 1, ni, uni, and ai plus 1. In steady state, the number of jobs in the system, or the average number of jobs in the system, is fixed. So the average of ni plus 1 is the same as the average of ni. And we get that the average of our unity function is the average of the number of arrivals. Okay. So the average number of arrivals in the time it takes to process a job defines the traffic intensity, and will be given by rho. U, our average U and I, is the fraction of time the system is busy, and we call this the system utilization. Okay. And so those, again, those two figures are equal for our system. Okay, so we'll sort of be coming back to at least the definition of these quantities as we sort of derive various results. Now, we're going to take a break there. When we return, we will see what we can say or what additional sort of results we can achieve now that we assume that our arrival process is Poisson. Okay, and this will be an analysis of Poisson arrivals, general service distribution queues. And again, if we know the second moment, we know a little bit more about the distribution, but not necessarily the exact distribution, then we can say something about the average number of jobs in the system or the average waiting time in the system. So we'll look at those results, and then we'll also start to look at results where, again, we assume that we have not a general service distribution, but a Poisson service distribution as well.